I no longer care how undignified I look, the mascara puddling down my cheeks, nor how inappropriate it is for me to be proclaiming President Kennedy's famous words, Ich bin ein Berliner. How dare I feel such emotion? I have been free all my life, when sitting beside me in the car and sobbing like me is teacher Wiebke Reed, who today has become free for the first time in her grey and fear-filled 48 years. We are hugging each other and she's screaming, I love you, Anne, and I'm screaming back, I love you, Wiebke. We're screaming the same at the huge crowd of West Berliners who are cheering Wiebke's battered little red Wartburg as it inches and coughs its way slowly across the no-man's land where so many have died. Frankly, I'm now slightly embarrassed about the over-emotional opening of that piece, which I wrote for the Daily Mail in November 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down. My excuse is that it was the most exciting and deeply moving 24 hours of my long professional life. I'd returned to Berlin, to where the wall once stood, to relive those historic moments with Wiebke, who was then working for me as my translator.
People lined this road and we have this sparkling wine, not champagne, sparkling wine.
Sekt.
And glasses, and we had to drink all the time.
Wiebke, your car had a little sliding open roof.
Yes, and you stood.
So I stood.
And Leslie looked out of this thing and waving her hands and said, where are we are East Berliners go over to come to you? And I said, Leslie.
No, I just was too overcome with emotion. Yes. Actually, I was, and so
of
were
course,
you.
Of course,
I remember shouting at you,
tears.
I love you. And you said, I love you.
I couldn't believe it.
And I'm the only person who was there that night who didn't pick up a piece of the wall.
Yeah.
And of course, now you can buy pieces of the so-called wall.
Now it's fake.
Yes.
At those days it was real. Yes. I still have some pieces. If you like,
you
can bring it.
Oh, you never gave me one.
No, I still have. I'll send you.
Okay.
I'll send you some little pieces.
Wiebke and I had driven together through Checkpoint Charlie, the crossing point between communist East Berlin and the western half of the city. As I reported at the time, a massive roar erupts from the West German crowd as we approach the sign, which, adorned with British, French and American flags, tells us and all the hundreds of little coughing Wartburgs and Trabants behind us, you are now entering the Allied zone. I cannot believe this, sobs Wiebke. Here am I, Wiebke Reed, driving freely across Checkpoint Charlie. All our lives we have dreamed of this. All our lives we have waited for this. And suddenly, now, at last it is happening. The night before, we'd been to a press conference given by Gunter Schabowski, the East German Minister of Propaganda and East Berlin Politburo boss, where he seemed to imply that East Germans were now free to travel to the West. Do you remember we rushed to Checkpoint Charlie,
yes,
where we're standing now?
Where we're standing now?
Yes. And there was nothing happening.
No.
It looked exactly like it did in the old black and white movies.
Yes.
Set in the Cold War. There were the Voppos, the border guards, and they were blowing on their fingers because it was so cold, and they were stamping their feet. But there was nobody else.
No.
And we went up to them and said, you know, just...
Haven't you heard?
And then I think one of them said, well, we heard something. We don't understand it.
Mm.
And we are trying to contact our superiors.
Mm.
We can't get in touch with them. And I think one of them was at the opera. So, and we said, well, obviously, either the East Germans, East Berliners are so scared and so cowed that they're staying at home or not going anywhere.
Waiting for the West German news to repeat the things, because the East German news, people didn't really watch it. At 7 o'clock, East German news were on, at 8 o'clock, West Germans. They were just sitting watching
then
West German television.
Do you remember, we thought, well, we better go and look at Friedrichstrasse,
yes,
the station.
Yes.
And same scene as at Checkpoint Charlie, nothing.
And, you know, I remember one man came with his glass of beer, his slippers, and he just came by and said, I just want to see if it's true. I just go over, but I come back. And the soldier said, okay, you go over, but you will come back, okay? Yes, I will. I thought it was kind of
comedy.
Surreal.
Yeah, surreal, really. Yeah.
And then there was a little group of young people wearing what was considered very, very cool in those days. Mm. Stonewashed jeans, you remember, and Turkish leather jackets. And they came and they were giggling nervously and saying, you know, we just want to go across for 20 minutes.
Yes.
Because we've seen West Germany on television, but we just want to go and look at it. And then suddenly, this huge crowd's built up.
Yes.
And you got nervous because
of
you
course.
Really...
I was so afraid. I thought, it can't be just peaceful. Somebody will shoot if the Soviets come or if Nationale Volksarmee, if National People's Army will shoot. I was afraid and I thought, I will go home and I left you poor.
You
I left you alone that night. It was exciting.
Of course, I didn't blame Wiebke, a single mother, for believing that we might be shot dead at the border. I'm a foreign correspondent and as a species, we childishly and inaccurately tend to believe that violent death won't befall us. Earlier, in other articles written from East Berlin, where I was working illegally, I'd changed Wiebke's name to protect her. At that point, neither she nor I were to know whether, as the communist regime called it, real existing socialism, and indeed its real existing prisons for real existing and tortured dissidents, would triumph or not. The fall of the wall was triggered by that press conference. 18 years later, I've tracked down Gunter Schabowski, the man whose confused announcement changed the face of 20th century history. But first, he introduced me to his beloved parrot.
His name is Puterle. Puter in German means turkey.
Schabowski was sentenced to 3 years for his role in the regime and now lives with his wife and the above-mentioned parrot in a small, unassuming apartment in West Berlin. At his press conference, he lit the touch paper which so quickly destroyed the Iron Curtain regimes and then, 18 months later, the Soviet Union itself. But he doesn't entirely agree with my version of that historic press conference.
And so there he behaves like a turkey.
There is one reaction of him on the left. And so we called him Puterle. Also, like Malinki Puter, yeah? Puterle, yeah? The Puterle.
Now, you will go down in history as having made a blunder.
Made a blunder? What has blunder?
At the press conference, Schabowski had growled his way through a boring, bureaucratic list of personnel changes. A few of us, including the ITN man beside me, were nodding off. Then, at 6:57, Schabowski picked up a piece of paper, which, when he read it out, suggested that East Germans were now being allowed to travel to the West. Our jaws dropped. At that time, it was a state crime to try and leave the country.
So, this paper, I got it in the session of the Central Committee the day before, in the afternoon. And we give the impulse to make such a decision by the government. As a political process, you must make it now, as a, because we have to save ourselves, it is good for the system, it's good for the party, make it. And the government made a draft.
So, and from that moment, the 28-year-old wall was effectively doomed.
As I can say, within 1 hour or 60 minutes, it was across the earth, sozusagen, yeah? But 3 kilometers from the press conference, it didn't go, sozusagen, because the border soldiers, they looked not television and they looked not radio, sozusagen.
Well, I went immediately after your announcement.
Yeah. And when was it immediately? Maybe 1 hour or?
No, I went as soon as you left the room. Uh-huh. I thought, I'll go to Checkpoint Charlie. The border guards, said, one of them said he'd heard this on the radio, Comrade Schabowski, we don't know anything about it. We don't understand. We're trying to get hold of our superiors. We can't get hold of them. But as you can see, there's nobody here. Right? There was nobody there. So I went to Friedrichstrasse station. Same reaction.
It's very interesting for me to meet somebody who immediately after the press conference went to the border.
Yeah. And there was no crowds, nothing at either checkpoint.
And he didn't believe himself what he read. He was kind of, what am I reading here? Is that true?
You suddenly said, you know, God, I think this is something big. And I woke up the ITN guy next to me. I said, hey, everybody started shouting, when does this come into being, this order to allow people to travel freely? And he then shuffled the paper again.
Yes.
And so, forth.
Yes.
Immediately.
And then, all the Western journalists, the Americans, the British journalists said, let's go there.
And I seem to remember he fled into the gents.
Yes.
Which, of course, we couldn't follow him there.
Right.
So all the Western correspondents piling all the mail once.
The state security police, the Stasi, the sword and shield of the party, which at its height outnumbered per head of population Hitler's Gestapo, terrified the masses, but granted vast privileges to the pampered communist elite. I asked Schabowski whether he and his fellow comrades had simply lost touch with the masses.
I could accept this as on the one side, but not on the other side. For a communist, or for a communist party, it is not that you are in distance to normal life. That isn't the question.
But we had your own shops, you had your own hospital,
clinics. That's right. But on the other hand, you see, the critical opinion is not very important, because communists are convinced that they realize a new society. That's difficult work, you see. And therefore, we also must have situations for living and to fulfill our own plans to lead the people. Yes, in comparison with the Western capitalists, we are modest people, you see, but also we are politically responsible, and therefore we must have some special supports for this important work which we fulfill for the common people, you see. This isn't the question. The question is that the ideology gives you the feeling you are like a pope of a special religion, you see.
Back then, how frightening the atmosphere was in the communist half of Berlin. There'd been numerous peaceful demonstrations against the regime, but who knew whether the protests would succeed? Before the fall of the wall, Wiebke had taken me to the Gethsemane Church in a particularly decrepit area of East Berlin to meet a young dissident called Mariana Biertler. As I wrote at the time, 3 weeks ago, Mariana Biertler began to prepare herself for death. As a church youth worker and a leading member of the unofficial Initiative for Peace and Human Rights, she was then close to despair. And who could blame this extraordinarily brave and stubborn woman for losing hope? The new party boss, Egon Krenz, who replaced hardliner Erich Honecker, looked like a creature forged in the same old Stalinist mold. Last month, I stood in Tiananmen Square in Peking and watched the man, who is now East Germany's leader, joyously embrace China's state security chief. And I felt sick to my stomach. Krenz, his sallow, hollow-eyed face wreathed with toothy grins, congratulated the Chinese government for the massacre of their own unarmed citizenry. Clearly, as far as Mariana Biertler was concerned, this was not a man who, if backed into a corner by the masses, would hesitate to impose what she, and everyone else I've talked to here in East Berlin, calls the Chinese solution. Here in this office, she told me, we have over 200 depositions from people who were beaten up, stripped naked, and tortured by the Stasi after the huge demonstration in the city in October. Frau Biertler, a tall, rangy woman in earnest, steel-framed spectacles, got up and rummaged among the boxes cluttering the office. It is all here, and we have formed an investigating commission to find out who at the top was responsible for ordering this.
I like the hairstyle.
You like?
Your hairstyle.
The hairstyle, thank
it
you very
changed.
Much.
It has changed.
Thank you. Maybe.
And you don't wear glasses anymore.
Now, many years later, Biertler and I meet again.
With memories of that
she
time,
greets me in her office, the former Office for Statistics. It was statistics which were largely fanciful.
It'll soon be demolished, but the smell of the old, drear, communist era, pickled cabbage, pungent, filthy petrol, a miasma of depression still seems to impregnate its walls.
Do you remember the date when we met?
I think it was the 8th. The wall came down on the 9th, didn't it? One of the things you said to me then was you loved your country, the DDR. You didn't want a reunited Germany. You just wanted...
Did I?
Yes, the DDR to be just more humane and more civilized. Do you remember that at all?
Yes. My position was that we first have to reform our own country. We wanted freedom and democracy and so on. And after the fall of the wall, we first think about reunification. It was not a part of our mind. We couldn't imagine it, and therefore I think I wasn't for the reunification and I wasn't against it. I couldn't imagine it. It was out of imagination.
Today, Bertler is now in charge of the Stasi archives.
When I saw you, you were showing me documents of people who had been suffered under the Stasi. And there were about 200 that you had. Did it ever strike you that one day you'd be in charge of Stasi files? I mean, this ironic thing that you were protecting Stasi victims, and now you're in charge of a commission looking at files.
Of course not. If somebody would have told it me, I would find that it was a fairy. No.
But this former campaigner against the Stasi is now being accused of keeping too much evidence about the Stasi hidden.
Some scientists or journalists can't accept that the rules for using the files, for the Stasi files, are very strong, because we have every day to decide what is more important, the right of the public to use the files or the right of the individual that information about his person is protected. And a lot of information we keep in our files, and therefore they cannot be used like normal or general files. And it's very difficult for scientists or other people to accept this. I can understand this difficulty, but it can't be helped. Otherwise, we couldn't use the Stasi files at all.
So the allegation that you are protecting some people who may be quite powerful politically is unfounded.
Of course not. Why should I? No.
One of Bertler's harshest critics is historian Hubertus Knabe. I talked to him at Hohenschönhausen, the former Stasi prison, which is now a museum, where Professor Knabe is the director.
We asked for the Stasi files, which we need for the scientific research, but especially this point is very difficult because we don't get what we want.
Now, do you think, because we saw Bertler this morning, as she says, the problem is that you have to balance the need to know with the human rights of the individual. Do you think, in fact, her commission is being too obstructive?
Yes, I think so. And it becomes more and more absurd because time is going on. And we have files of the 50s, for example, which are not much older than the files of the Gestapo, for example, only 5 or 10 years between. And therefore, we think we must not put more restrictions against researchers, but we must open the files more than in the past. And this whole state office was, in my point of view, sort of compromise between the revolution, which wanted to open the files, and the state interest to get it under control. And it's acting like this.
That's a pity from your point of view, isn't it? I mean, have you had great arguments with Biertler about this?
Yes, we have a very vivid discussion now in Germany about these questions, because it's very difficult to get them. For example, we tried to get the files of the former prisoners here, and we wrote down more than 200 names, and we gave also the permission of the victims that we can have these files. And till now, during 10 years, perhaps we've got 20 of those files.
What is the justification? You've got permission from the former prisoners.
Yes.
They've got the files. So what is the justification for not giving them to you?
They say they haven't enough staff to do this, but they have 2,000 employees. We have got only 12 here. It's a very big apparatus, and big apparatuses normally work slowly.
One of the many who fell foul of the Stasi was Gisela Quasdorf. For the crime of trying to escape from the country, she was imprisoned for 2 years. Today, Gisela is a tour guide at this former jail. What impact did the Stasi have on her life?
I did not know to live anymore. How could I live? I get not jobs anymore. I could not go anywhere anymore, except I have only stayed in my country. I was 21 years old. My life was finished before I began this, my life.
And did you think ever of suicide? Did you ever think of suicide?
Also this, I was thinking about. This was also, I suicide or I try to leave the country. So this was the only chance.
Last year, I watched the fascinating and moving film about East Berlin in the 80s called The Lives of Others, directed by a young West German, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. It was about a guilt-ridden Stasi officer who had to spy on a dissident theatre director and his mistress. But it's been very controversial in East Germany itself. Raking up this painful past isn't popular with everyone, not least because many of them know that they were, to some degree, complicit.
Mr. Donnersmarck asked for permission to make the film here, and we discussed the book, and we said, no, if you can name anybody of Stasi who acted like this, please tell me one example, then you can do whatever you want. And he couldn't. And he argued that Schindler's List was also a very important film, and you see that there weren't only bad guys, but also good Germans. And I said, that's a big difference. Mr. Schindler existed, and imagine that this film were made and Mr. Schindler didn't exist, and then there would be a big scandal, and therefore we didn't give the permission to make the film here, because we don't know any case like this, and then it's difficult to make such a film authentic place. The film is not really bad, because it was a very important film to sensibilize the society, and it won the Oscar and everything, so Stasi was really very discussed topic in this time, and till now perhaps also in an international public opinion, but the film itself is problematic because the story isn't true. Sometimes I said the story is too nice to be true. It's a German phrase. Yes, it's a German phrase. Too nice to be true.
Was there a danger that it would make some people feel, because the main character is sympathetic and he sacrifices his career to help the people that he'd been spying on, do you think that it makes people feel, well, the Stasi wasn't that bad?
Yes, of course, in the younger generation we made the experience that they think that there was a big oppositional movement in the East German secret police, but we don't know anything about this oppositional movement. In the 50s, it's true that a lot of Stasi employees left East Germany and went to West Germany, but in the 80s it didn't exist, and it makes problematic picture of Stasi, especially for the younger generation. We know something about this time, but the younger generation doesn't know anything.
As I left the former Stasi prison and walked out into the housing estate on its doorstep, I knew that this area had been home to many Stasi men and their families, and it still is. Professor Knaber told me that not a single Stasi officer had been jailed for his role in the regime. Sadly, 18 years after the fall of the wall, there still exists, as Berliners put it, a wall in the head. Vessies, West Germans, resent the allegedly lazy Ossies, East Germans, who in turn resent the allegedly arrogant Vessies. The physical wall may have fallen, but the wall in the head will take much longer to disappear. Mariana Biertler.
I feel two different cultures still. And there are some facts who separate East Germans and West Germans, perhaps. In our institution, people from West Germany and East Germany work together. But because I'm from East Germany, I get only 90% of that what I would get if I come from the West. Look at our government. There are about 15 ministers. Three of them are from the East. And when you look at media or economy or so, you will nearly almost find in the important positions people from the West, and East German feel that.
When I first met her, back in 1989, Mariana recited to me the words of a song by the East German dissident Wolf Biermann, very popular then among enemies of the state like her. Tell me, when is this trouble going to end? Answer, when the new trouble arrives.